This talk today is called Secret Agents. And I would just like to play with a few different kinds of secret agents that I've noticed helping us deepen on the spiritual path. In case you don't know the English phrase, it would be like a kind of spy, someone who looks like maybe they're here on retreat, but they're really coming from the FBI or whatever. They're coming from the secret police of India or whatever. The first way that I've seen secret agents is in what I call Papaji's Mafia. So Papaji is the affectionate name that we gave to my teacher Punjaji. He's the Indian wrestler that I mentioned a few days ago. He loved to do what we call stir the pot. So someone might ask Papaji, could I give teachings? Do you want me to teach? And Papaji would say, And then the person would come out of the room saying, Papaji asked me to teach. And Papaji would then, we'd say in English, egg the person on, like play along with the game. Sometimes. Another way that what I called Papaji's Mafia manifested was not anything to actually do with what Papaji himself was doing, but I was living around him and his teachings for about 7 years. And it seemed like sometimes bad luck would happen that turned out to be good luck. So it happened many, many times that people would be about to leave Lucknow. They had enough of all of this teaching. And they would just go up onto the roof of the house to get their underwear off the laundry line. And they wouldn't be able to get back down. The door would be mysteriously locked. But no one else in the house to lock it. And a few hours later, once the train had left, somehow, maybe someone would come by and they would scream help or whatever, or somehow the door would just open. And it could be just somewhere in the person, something not wanting to go, and the door seemed to be stuck. Who knows? It happened a lot. Another part of what I call Papaji's Mafia is what we call on retreat the Vipassana villain. So sometimes someone may come to an interview and say, I don't know what is wrong with me. I don't know what's going on, but I just hate this person. I don't even know them. What's going on? I'm going insane. And we say, yes, that's this phenomenon called the Vipassana villain. It happens every time. In fact, it happens all the time. It's just more noticeable on retreat. But how can that phenomenon, the Vipassana villain is the bad guy in the movie, or the bad girl, whatever. How does that phenomenon, or how could that phenomenon, how could that fact, that happening, actually be part of helping us deepen? Not just that we try to learn about our anger and try to accept and try to do metta and whatever we try to do, but how is that actual specific person who's driving us crazy one of the best things that ever happened to us? So there's a few ways I'd like to go into this subject. One, just to inspire us, is to talk about one of the kind of spiritual ancestors of Tibet who took some of Buddhism from India to Tibet. And as he was planning his trip to go to Tibet, one of the most important things that he included in his in what he brought with him was not just sort of a few robes and some extra coats or whatever, but what he called the tea boy, so the guy that made him tea who drove him crazy. So you would think, wow, great, I got the assignment. I get to go to Tibet as far away as possible from that annoying guy that makes my tea. But the tea boy was the first thing on the list that I really want the tea boy to come with me to Tibet. Because he really keeps showing me where I am indulging in suffering. And the story goes that once they got to Tibet together, the Tibetan spiritual ancestor realized there was no need to bring anyone along because it comes with you wherever you go. You'll find your new tea boy as soon as you arrive. So if someone who kind of is fully dedicated to intensive practice uses as a main practice spending as much time as possible with the most annoying person, what is that starting to tell us? So I'd like to talk about two different kinds of people that might annoy us. One comes from a conversation I had with Ajay this afternoon. So Ajay received a note from someone here asking Ajay to talk freely instead of using his book, to talk from his heart about how Eastern wisdom and Western youth could meet. That was the question. And so Ajay said, could you please, because this question really came from the person's heart, I don't know who it is, but it really came from the heart, so please. If this fits in your talk, please say, and it fits perfectly. So Ajay's response to the question was, it has to do with the first step in Eastern wisdom meeting Western youth, but why don't we open it out from youth to Westerners? All of us may need to grow up a bit at whatever age we are. He said, the first step, the important thing to mention is about parents. And I thought, how's this going to go into my talk? I said, okay, but I really love you so much, I'll do my best. Okay. So what Ajay was pointing out is whatever kind of parents we had, whether we like them or do not like them, the fact that culturally we are kind of supposed to reject them and kind of not really get over that rejecting phase is part of the reason that we keep searching and not finding. And if we could do, the way I would put it, if we could do a simple gesture of thanking our parents for giving us this life, it's a kind of symbolic gesture that can help us connect with another kind of source that's not just the source of the biological life. So instead of kind of adding more and more fuel to the fire of being anti-parents, we can not even get into whether we forgive them or not for being hellish or whatever. But we would not be here if they had not given us life. And so that very basic kind of level, feeling and allowing a connection to happen and a kind of honoring of that gift. Another kind of difficult person that probably all of us have come across somehow or other. There's the English word nemesis. We meet our nemesis. We meet that person who seems to be our shadow, our opposite. They seem to have exactly the neurosis that bothers us and that we do not have. And it really gets to us. So what's important to notice, and when we start to get the idea of what kind of person or what kind of behavior especially bothers us, out of all the millions of behaviors that have gone on, for example, on this retreat in these 10 days, there are one or two kinds of behaviors that bother you a lot. Maybe in yourself, but probably also outside of yourself. And that does tell us something about ourselves. If we're willing to accept that it's not about that person being right or wrong, and it's not in our control anyway, one person that I love the teachings, Byron Katie, says, if we try to change that person first, it's like trying to get a dog to meow or a cat to bark. But we can notice that it's these specific things that are really getting my fire going, getting my brain speedy, clenching my stomach or whatever. And that somehow, even if I hate that behavior in them, and I think, I would never do that. I would never come in late. I would never be noisy. I would never. I can almost promise you that you do. Somewhere you do. And even if what, and maybe even especially, if what you see someone else doing bothers you, and it especially bothers you because you would never, it's exactly because you would never, you were maybe trained all your life, you cannot, this is not allowed, that's exactly why it bothers you. Something in you wants to be free that sometimes I might come in late, sometimes I might be noisy, or whatever the thing is. So when we see our mind busy with what others are doing, whether it's in the global scale or in the family scale or in this room or in your friends or whatever, it's probably in all of those scales. It's probably in the microcosm and the macrocosm. If we can start to hear what our mind is saying by focusing on the subject. Even if I'm saying no, no, no. The mind focuses on the subject because it's our subject. And it slowly, if we can accept that maybe we're not so perfect or maybe we're not so weak or whatever, we can let that subject be our specialization. There's an amazing person that I managed not to mention in a Dharma talk all season. I mentioned him in every talk last year, in India and in the West. Katora knows who I'm talking about, Maria probably. So he was a French man in the last century who as a boy was blinded in an accident. And he had the good luck that he was not encouraged to take the accident as bad luck. And I think that's one of the key important points that we could learn from him. That he was blinded in an accident at the age of 8 at school. Not really anyone's fault. Definitely completely lost the sight of his eyes, the use of his eyes. Loved the light, loved the light. He used to run up and down the street with the light. But because this was something that just happened, he was able to let it give him some kind of traction to grow up from, something to kind of, in a way, support him to grow even more into the light. And so pretty soon, when he went to visit a park with his father, a park that he knew, the trees, he knew them, he started to learn how to see again without his eyes, but he could see. This is the kind of miracle that can happen when we let what could have looked like bad luck turn out to be something that we can use to actually help us stand up. And there's one specific part of his life that I find as an amazing image. It's something that really happened and also an amazing image for our spiritual life. In his life, probably the two most intense times were when he was blinded and learning how to see again, being a boy and growing up into a man, just 8 years old, a few years and then adolescence. And the second most intense time, probably somehow more intense, was in a concentration camp as a young man. And part of what happened in the concentration camp is an amazing real event that can help us tune into possibility. Like sometimes I just feel to remember anything is possible when it looks like bad luck is the only thing that's happening. So in the concentration camp, because his name is Jacques Lucéran, I don't know if I said his name. Because he knew quite a few languages, he kind of dove into the job of giving the news to all the different groups of people. If he could give it in their language, he would. Or he would stand next to the translator and make sure that it was translated properly. But the way he got the news from inside the concentration camp. So the image is, here we are under the influence of our crazy minds, feeling stuck inside our skin. How do we get the news of what's actually happening, of what is, and not just the false stories that are coming from the mind, from the past? By listening, what he did at first was listening to the news that was given by the Nazis over the loudspeakers to the camp. He listened to the so-called official news, and he translated it. So, for example, towards the end of the war, he just listened with full concentration to what was being said so that he could notice what is being left out. They stopped mentioning Paris, and he would wait until he was sure that Paris had been liberated, and he would then go around and tell the camp, all around the camp, for everyone to know Paris is liberated. So this is the kind of thing we can hear what the mind is saying and translate to know what is actually happening. By hearing what is being said, what is being focused on, what seems to be important, and then feeling the reversal of that, and then hearing what is not being said in the mind. So a small example. If we're having a kind of hard day, we're feeling reactive or tight, and we start to notice things that someone should have taken out the trash, or why did they leave their honey there, or they didn't put the dishwater, or whatever. If we can be a little bit playful and open enough to notice the things that we're not noticing that someone did do, for example. So just these small things make a big difference. Sometimes we do better when we know we're under pressure and we feel like it's a really intense, urgent situation, then we really pay attention. But when it's just daily life and we're in a bad mood and why didn't they park the car in the right place or whatever, why do they drive the car anyway? It's their fault that there's global warming or whatever. Let's notice also what the mind is not paying attention to. Is there a question so far? One example that comes as we continue into the rest of the story. As the war was really about to end, that war, it was being announced differently each day what was going to happen to the camp and the people in it. If everyone was going to be liberated, if they followed the soldiers out of the camp, if what they should do is stay, if everyone was going to be killed anyway, etc. So it was different every day. The news was different. Towards the end, when it's, you can, what Jacques could hear in the news is that there is no more confidence. There's no more certainty. They're not even able to stick to one story. So he could hear, this is about to fall apart. What he could not hear in the news was what is actually going to happen. What are the plans? What are really... But the cool thing about the story, the real story and the inner story, is at a certain point, someone just passing Jacques in on the grounds or something gave Jacques a piece of news that couldn't have come from hearing the official news. It came from somewhere else, and Jacques didn't know where it had come from at first. So that's like we're in meditation and we're trying to attend to the difficult mind. And then something comes like a fresh breeze and we don't know where it came from, but we know it's true. We can feel in our bones it's true. And at first, no one's telling us where this came from. And it can often feel like, even if we've heard all these Dharma talks that are telling you this is going to happen, it feels like, how come no one told me? So what turned out to be happening already was other people, because in this camp were actually a lot of the freedom fighters, the resistance fighters. Other people had created out of some of the material that they found in the basement of the camps that was meant for a destructive purpose. They had used that to create a radio station in the basement of the concentration camp. And they were receiving news from the so-called free world every day. At first, the person who gave the little bit of news to Jacques couldn't even safely say, this is the case, there's a radio station. We're going to keep getting information. It's just when that comes, that breeze comes, and you don't know where it comes from, if it's ever going to come again. But something else in us that in a way needs to stay secret for a while. We need to not know that it's happening, because if we would know, we might start talking too much about it. We might start thinking too much about it. And that would endanger the whole sort of project or whatever, the whole chance for liberation. And slowly, slowly, as there starts to be more and more trust, it's possible to actually know there is some place inside that has been made from what used to be used for destruction that is receiving true information. And so we're getting true information from inside and from outside. Can I just say one more thing? So what helps build the trust so that we can eventually know about that radio station in the basement? That place that gets an honest voice from the free world. What happened for Jacques is that because of the way he was able to grow up from being blinded, because he learned to see without eyes, he kind of had such a clear training from what seemed to be a difficult situation that when he was connected to what these days I'm calling to myself network coverage, tuning into love in the background and letting that take care of what needs to be taken care of. By staying tuned to, for him, what was called love or light, he saw light inside when he was connected, and it went nearly dark when he disconnected. And so he had this training as a child that when he was playing with his friends, if he suddenly had to be first, he couldn't see. And if he remembered that he'd rather see than be first, he could play again. So if we could see how this is true for us, it's just that it's not our physical eyes. And if we could take it that clearly and seriously inside, that we can feel when I'm connected, and then suddenly I want to be first, I want to be better than, I want to indulge in worse than, or whatever the story, however it goes. If I go for that story, I'm blind, and I can't play anymore. And since I'd rather play, let me come back to being able to see. So what's more important than being right, for example? I think it's that training over years that allowed him to function in the way he did as a blind person in the concentration camp. At first, people stole his bread, his fellow prisoners stealing his bread. And then he again had to come back to that connection. The connection is more important than bread. And then they stopped stealing his bread. So deepening in that connection, not giving up, trusting that connection makes us trustworthy to receive by radio. Yes, go. If you speak a little loudly, so I don't have to.
So sometimes it feels like what comes into my head is even in words, it feels like it's a, it's like a, it's a helpful hand, it's a hint about like where I need to be loving myself. And it seems these days though that it's almost exactly the same types of thought patterns just get latched onto by my mind and used in a way in which just pulls me out of connection.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost exactly the same content. Like
the same content that disconnects you as what's the thing?
So the theme is the same as where I need love, you
know, yes.
Like on the path. And exactly. But then my mind still latches onto you and it just churns away with it.
Yes. Exactly. So that's where our nemesis, or our Vipassana villain, is training us in our theme. This is where you could indulge in suffering, or you could turn it around and connect so that the love can come from in and out to that little wound or that big wound or whatever. Yes, go ahead.
These days sometimes it's been feeling like I don't know whether to put that action in, like I don't know whether to turn in and do that, you know,
mm-hmm.
or I want, or if I should just be like, no, like enough is enough.
Right.
Good. I don't know.
Good. Good. So it's, I also agree that, could you hear?
Not really.
Not really. So if I understood well, this will help me know, make sure I understood you also, if I repeat. That yes, sometimes I can notice that I'm going into a suffering story, and that exactly points me to where I need to connect to let life love. But sometimes I don't know if I need to do that disconnect from here and connect here movement. Is that what you're saying? Or just to say bus enough?
Yeah, because sometimes it just seems like it's just adding fuel to something.
Yes.
Doesn't.
Good. So I like the openness that sometimes we need to do the gesture, unplug, plug. And sometimes we need to not be involved in the presence or absence of that pattern. And just a tree, something else, let it go on like a little babbling brook on the side. Various options, not only the one thing that focuses sometimes too much on the pattern in trying to heal it. Is that your question statement?
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Any follow through coming to mind?
I was just touched by what you were saying about how sometimes it's very important that it's kept secret. And wondering if that was the case at the moment. Like, kind of last few days, been wandering around going, I haven't got a clue.
Yeah.
But at the same time, something's going, yeah, but something's happening.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Could you hear that? Yes. Could you hear that over there? Okay. So that's an, I would like to now go more into that kind of secret agent. See. So there's a couple of different ways that we can learn to accept that we can keep on going with our spiritual practice without knowing what's actually happening, and maybe even especially because we don't know what's happening. So people have done, and they start to do more and more research on meditators, hooking them up to machines and measuring things. And one of the common elements that they see, which is only just, it's only common probably to a certain point, but what happens first is that the centers in the left brain, so that's the one that goes with the right hand, which is more about analysis and logic and step by step. The language centers in the left brain start to quiet down. So those moments that we are less involved and less empowering the commentary is something that we have in common with other people who do their spiritual practice. But that sometimes happens. Sometimes the mind is talking, there's just less emphasis, and sometimes we can't find that aspect of the mind. which can be disorienting. It can even leave us feeling like, what just happened, or am I hallucinating, or whatever. The next step, and the only step so far that I've read that people have kind of specified, there might be other ones, but what they've specified that happens as a next step as we start to go in, after the language centers in the left brain quiet down, another center in the left brain also quiets down. So our emphasis on the left brain in our education quiets down in these two ways. One is the language, and the second one is, it's called the, well, it's about spatial, it's about physical boundaries in space. It's called the orientation association area. That goes quiet. So the sense of being located somewhere is not, the brain is not telling itself that I'm located here. And that can also be disorienting. We can also feel, I don't know where I was. There's another thing that happens sometimes. And again, I just, as I've said a few times in the hall, like to keep in mind that even if there are things that are in common, we're all very much dancing it in our own way. And someone might have plenty of talking going on, but they're right into this third flavor of meditation, which is experiences that we could say are secret to myself. Because exactly, I was not active. The I was not active during that time. And so I cannot report back to myself about what happened. Not only were there not words going on there at the time, not only do I not even know where it was, I was, they were, whatever. But we can already get the sense when there's not a physical location that there's much less sense of me and you, or separation, duality. But when there's actually not I going on, there's not a way of reporting to the conscious brain what went on. So in our experience, what might be is we say, wow, that was a really nice sleep. Was I asleep? It might be like that. And that might happen for years before you have any actual thing that you can report to someone and say, this is why I'm using my life this way. This is why it's fruitful. There may be nothing to report to the outside world that makes sense. Maybe the scientists will find some more brain centers and we can talk about it that way, and people will go, oh, wow, okay. And maybe not. So the weird thing is that we're going along and doing our best. And in my experience with myself and others, many times our interpretation of what's going on, so the way we tell our spiritual story, is almost exactly the opposite of what's really happening. Where I think I'm doing well is where I'm really developing a nice, juicy spiritual ego. And where I think I'm falling apart and doing badly and spacing out is where something is going on. They're using the medical equipment to make a radio station down there. Thank God. What can help, other than being very loose, like noticing when I'm telling a story about how I'm doing well or badly, because the moments of despair will come, and please don't let it stop you. That's a time to really go for a hug or some encouragement. I think that's one of the best roles we can play for each other, is knowing despair will come. In a way, it has to, because we do have these stories that go on about how well we're doing, and if we keep going, that is going to fall apart. How I'm so kind, or how I'm developing my metta, or whatever. If we keep going, that has to fall apart to let the seed has to break open for the plant to sprout. And from the inside, that experience is devastation and earthquake. And sometimes from the outside, it's easy to say, like, look, you have a little root that can drink. Part of what that means is if I know that I'm doing this such and such technique, like being with the breath, and I start to notice more and more times that I'm spacing out, or more and more times that I fall asleep, or dream, or something else is happening, it can be good to talk to someone with experience. But it can also be good to stay very loose about what you think is happening. So for example, if you're, for example, being with the breath, it could be any other object. We start by being aware of objects. And I start to feel a kind of inner bubbling up, or a kind of gently weighing down. And then after a while, I go, oh, the breath, I've got to get back to the breath. And in that, got to get back to the breath, I'm disturbing my meditation. So at first, it can be hard to know when I'm really just not enthusiastic about my practice. I've forgotten how juicy it can be, or whatever. So it can help to talk to people with experience. But if we really can let ourselves follow the joy and lightness, that starts to take us on this wave that takes us to the more and more subtle, instead of the usual wave that takes us to the more and more unsubtle, sticking to the technique, for example. It can also help to break down some of the images that we might unconsciously be trying to follow, and then we can feel, oh, I'm doing well because that's what that Tibetan Lama said, or that's what they said their experience, or I read about that experience in the book. All these images that we have of where we're supposed to be going. It can help to hear about people that are said to be enlightened, remembering that we don't know. They are supposedly enlightened, but maybe they really were. And throughout history, when those people have been remembered, which is not always, it's also nice to remember that there could be thousands of them that have never been recorded. But the ones that were remembered and that are remembered, some of them did not follow our images. So I remember one story that I love of a woman who is said to be enlightened. And a man who ended up being a famous Indian teacher heard about her. He heard she was enlightened, and he searched her out in the middle of the hot plains of India, centuries ago. And someone pointed him to this one vegetable market and said, she's the one there selling the vegetables. And the man who's about to be a saint looks over and he sees two vegetable-selling women in an all-out fight, yelling at each other. Maybe like, you stole my potatoes or whatever. They probably didn't have potatoes then, sorry. You stole my bitter gourd. Or you're taking up some of my space that my ancestors have always used to sell millet. And luckily, instead of turning around and going back home, this man went to the woman and got teachings, and it helped him. And then she probably went back to her argument. There's a story in the Buddhist tradition where there are some disciples of Buddha, some monks, I think they are, who had come earlier from a lower caste. Once they become monks, they leave behind the caste system, supposedly. But they were coming into contact with one senior monk teacher who was one of the Buddha's students, who also had his own students. And they came to complain to the Buddha. They said, this guy, you're letting him teach. He's so arrogant. He's always putting us down. And the Buddha said, okay, wait a second, let me hear. That doesn't sound good, but let me hear, like, who is the person? Tell me the name. And so they told the name to the Buddha, Gautama Buddha. And the Buddha said, oh yeah, in his last six lifetimes, he was a Brahmin. He can't really help it. It's just these past tendencies are so strong from so many lifetimes of being from the higher class that it's really worth putting up with that to receive his wisdom. It's not the kind of way the story should go, but that's how it goes. So something in us sometimes could be ready to receive the, they like to use, the Papaji used to use the word rascal a lot. I seem to hear that a lot in India, rascal. The people who are willing to look unenlightened because they are free. Something in us might feel a kind of subtle attraction. Instead of the mind agrees, that looks like a really great teacher. Something, we can give room to that subtle heart opening, even when the personality is disturbing. Being careful with this, of course, like room for the heart. Sometimes the heart says no, not that one, no matter how great everyone says he or she is. No way. So going with the heart and giving space, maybe later on that changes. I have a friend who has spent many decades in India. He's an Englishman. And he also ended up being a devotee of Papaji, of Punjaji. And I think 10 or maybe even 20 years before actually meeting Papaji and receiving his teachings, this my friend Peter was in Haridwar, where Papaji loved to hang out, like Mariaji with the Babas, by the river. And Peter was just on the same bank of the river, 100 meters down, and he'd heard about Papaji, who was called Scorpion Baba at the time, because he sounds like a motorbike kind of guy, which, in a way, yeah. Because he could heal scorpion stings. He had a way to heal them. So he was, of course, this is where the tendency of the mind goes to the unsubtle. So this wonderful, amazing person is known as, his name is Scorpion Baba, because he can heal a scorpion sting, not because he can really get to the point with his sharp whip of a tongue, which he could. So my friend Peter was looking for a teacher. His teacher is 100 meters down the bank. He's heard about him, but maybe there wasn't the pull at that time. Maybe there was, but his mind said, Scorpion Baba, I'm not interested in the healer. I want teachings of freedom. And so 10 or 20 years later, he considers Papaji the love of his life. Like he said, now I understand what soulmate means. And he's married to this beautiful woman who also knows what soulmate means, their teacher. So being open to people who bring out the worst in us, those villains, people who bring out the best in us, people who can, I think that's maybe why there's that like kind of slight opening or pull in the heart that we can even feel when the mind is getting heavy. An image that I have is like someone who can see us, that we're in a ring of fire, and it's really hot, we're getting burned by our habits of suffering. But there's a way out. So they're not just saying, oh, wow, you're really suffering, that must hurt, you poor thing. They see the fire, but they especially see the way out. It's not a full circle. There's a pathway out. Meeting people that keep that in their heart when we are together might be more important than the discomfort of putting up with something that then seems small, like arrogance or whatever. And maybe finally the most rascally thing that someone could do. Being with us in the ring of fire, feeling how we could walk out our free pathway out. And then we do. And just as we do, the person that we thought helped us disappears. So Papaji used to say, I'm not the body, also I'm not the mind. And people would fight over sitting close to him, to be close to the body. And I just remember one interview and film that was with him, I think it's the very end. He's looking right into the camera with his powerful eyes, laughing and saying, ah, you think, he could see his reflection in the lens of the video camera. And he said, ah, you think that's who I really am. So just the very end of the story of Jacques Luceron and the camp. They were getting the news that the troops are coming and liberating, coming across the countryside and getting closer. And at that point, it made a difference if it was 1 kilometer or 2 kilometers away, because there wasn't much food. And who knew what the people with the guns would do. And so staying very accurate in the connection to the freedom and how we apply that when we're still in our ring of fire, when we're still in our concentration camp or whatever. Like really feeling fully the both, the news from the freedom and the fact that we're still in the camp, that can be really hard to accept how much we're tied in with barbed wire. Not through our own fault, but here we are. And how close is that freedom? Staying really steady, clear, honest in those moments. They might be moments that happen from time to time, rather than thinking, oh, maybe in 20 years I'll be in that place. From time to time we feel as if the breath of freedom is on our necks, and we feel the barbed wire on our arms. Being especially careful in those moments, that we don't give in to despair and we don't give in to being so excited that we bump into the barbed wire. Staying with the secret heart, saying what needs to be said, doing what needs to be done. And in the end, as I said, it wasn't clear what was going to happen. If everyone would just be killed, if they would be left to starve, if they would be taken somewhere else. And it so happened in this case, just to give the roundness of the real story, that people were told, the announcement was, if you come marching out of the camp, you go through the barbed wire with us, you will survive. You will be allowed to live. We'll take you somewhere where there's food also. And there was no other information coming from anywhere else to say yes or no. This was just the official announcement. And Jacques just felt solid as a rock. And the way it came out of his mouth was, don't abandon the ship. He also found it strange. It's not a ship. And why not? It's sinking. There's no food. They might kill us anyway. The announcement was, if you stay, you'll be shot. If you leave, you'll live. And Jacques said, don't abandon the ship. And he was like singing this going around. And the vast majority of people did go out and didn't get far. And some people stayed, and it was very difficult. Some people died in those days, starvation. And the camp was liberated. And some of those people, most of those people that stayed, did live. This brings a little bit the feeling of what Stu was saying, I think. Like, we've been trusting the news, and we've been going by that, and then we're not really sure. There's not that news, the other news, I can't tell what they mean. I can't read my crazy mind. I'm not getting, like, that divine intervention that tells me. And then somehow it comes out of my mouth, secret to myself. I didn't know it before I said it. Don't abandon the ship in a weird image. It would be easy to think, under pressure, he's lost it. He helped everyone so much, but now Jacques, which happened. So if we just stay true to the end, not that there's an end, but stay true right out the door to what even could be risking our life, but more important to stay true to that than stay alive. Not to buy the story about the group enlightenment, the group freedom, those people that have been lying all along, those voices. Let's have a few minutes silence together.